Welcome to the ACEC Engineering Influence Podcast, brought to you by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Today, I am joined by Chris Stallo and Joe Skorczewski from the Chartwell Financial Advisory. Chris is a managing director with Chartwell and has been with the firm for over 23 years. He has spent the past 12 years leading Chartwell's architecture and engineering practice. Joe is a director at Chartwell and has been working with Chris in the AE practice for most of his 15 years at the firm. We've invited Joe and Chris to speak with us today about some of the emerging trends with regard to ownership and compensation in AE firms. Welcome, Joe and Chris. Thanks for joining us. To start off, what is the state of the current market? What are engineering firms looking to Chartwell for?
You know, after some initial panic when COVID first broke out, we actually saw a pretty quick return to what we would call normalcy. We actually managed to close a couple of transactions back in April, much to, I think, our initial surprise. And so really we're seeing companies come to us, you know, looking for not only traditional third party, you know, sales transactions, but also new ESOP formations and a fair amount of just consulting around helping them think through their ownership advisory issues. We see a number of companies that are currently struggling with how do they infuse enough capital into their organizations as companies transition out, you know, some of their previous ownership.
Are there any specific issues that you see as commonplace in the projects that you're working on?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that has become really a recurring theme for us is that the companies that are privately held have this constant issue of having to transition the ownership of the business. And that's true whether the company is formed as an ESOP or whether they just have broad-based ownership in their organizations. And so what is happening right now is, given the demographics of society, we're having a lot of people who are retiring from companies, and the amount of capital that is available to come back into the organization through investments by other employees to replace those shareholders who are leaving is oftentimes not significant enough to make it, you know, make it worthwhile and to actually affect those transactions in a manner that you know, you would hope to see on a recurring and regular basis.
Yeah, I have actually a story to add. There's a client of ours that recently came to us, and they do a fun, you know, this is pre-pandemic, they do a fun Friday, you know, morning trivia question, and everybody goes on the chalkboard and answers the question or answers ABC. And the question was, if you won $1 million, what would you do with it? And A was, I would go buy a boat. B was, I would, you know, put it in savings. And C was, I would pay off my student loans or other debts. And 80% of the firm answered C. And the owner of the firm came to me and he said, Joe, who am I going to sell my company to? Right? My employees do not have their own personal balance sheets to buy me out. So what should I do?
Yeah, so I think that really speaks to, you know, a significant shift in the way that ownership is transitioned in businesses today. You know, we've all heard stories from our clients and you know, older folks in these firms who have talked about how, you know, how they came to their ownership in the business, and they went out and got a second mortgage on their house and, you know, did things of that nature to be able to buy into an organization. And today we're not seeing you know, people having the willingness to do that, in many cases, really even having the capability of doing that because of the amount of student debt that they're saddled with when they're coming out of school. And for, you know, a lot of people, it's might take them 10 years to, you know, pay off that student debt. And so they don't have that financial resources available to them to actually invest in these firms.
So that presents a quandary for firms. What are some of the considerations that companies should take when they're thinking about compensation and ownership questions then?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So one of the things that we have seen frequently as companies are thinking about these issues is, you know, really trying to understand how they align their compensation programs with what they're trying to accomplish from an ownership perspective. And too many times there's a disconnect between those things. Oftentimes they're thought about in sort of vacuums. You might have a firm that puts together this great compensation program, but it doesn't necessarily get them to where they need to be from an ownership perspective. And by that, I mean, oftentimes you'll see companies utilize stock as part of their compensation programs, either in the form of a long-term incentive program or as part of their annual bonus structure. And if there is not enough dollars or enough stock being utilized in those programs to actually affect the transitions of the older folks in the organization, then that's not going to really work from a sustainable ownership perspective. If indeed the goal is to, you know, maintain the ownership of that company as a privately held organization inside the, you know, existing construct.
So what are some of the tools that firms can use to address these issues then?
Yeah, so there's a variety of things out there. You know, oftentimes we see people think about programs such as stock appreciation rights, utilizing stock options or phantom stock, things of those natures that generally are some sort of what we call synthetic equity. So they're equity-like instruments, but they're not actual equity in the organization. And so people will use those as part of their compensation programs, again, usually in the form of some sort of a long-term incentive program. The other component that we often see companies look at is just going to stock bonuses or setting up programs where a portion of the cash bonus that the company is providing to their employees is expected to be utilized as part of the repurchase, or I should say the purchase of stock back in the organization. There's an interesting sort of psychological element to that we hear people talk about, and really management teams have different philosophies on this front, but sometimes they'll utilize stock bonuses as part of the program, and they feel like they're, you know, quote unquote, giving stock to their employees. Whereas if we cut them a check for their bonus and then they need to make a decision to actually turn around and write a check back to the company to buy stock in the organization, that there's a different sort of mentality behind that for the employees, right? That there's more of a feeling of having skin in the game in that regard. So that's something that we see frequently as well.
You know, I'll add one unique tool that we've seen come back to life is deferred compensation, and I'll again walk through a particular story. There's, as has been well documented, there's the talent war in this industry is real, and further, there's a specific gap of these sort of 10 to 15 year folks, project managers, future leaders of the firms. And there's a shortage of them actually dating back to the recession 2008-09. And the many of the owners of the firm don't want to reach down too far to provide ownership to a 30-year-old, let's say, for example. But they really want to retain that individual, and that individual is in high demand, and they don't want to lose them. So what we've seen happen in that case is there's can be some sort of deferred compensation plan put into place where you might award that individual a series of bonuses, 10,000, 20,000, whatever the number is, that vest over a period of years, say 3 or 5 years. And then the presumption is that at the end of 3 or 5 years, that person would then be in a better position. And like Chris said, that award would vest, that person would get paid, and that person would turn around and purchase stock in the company. So it's a way to extend a little bit deeper down into the organization, which can be useful depending on the demographics of your specific firm.
Yeah, and so maybe just, two other elements of this to add to the discussion. So one of the other tools that we've seen companies utilize is their 401k. And what they'll do in some instances is create a stock fund inside their 401k of their own company stock that they allow their employees to invest in, and or utilize stock in the company as part of their matching contribution to the employees' dollars to get more shares into circulation in the organization. So frequently we're seeing companies look at that as a creative solution. And then the other element of this that is sort of becoming more common, I would say, is this idea of a contributory ESOP. And the idea behind that really is that, you again would use the stock of the corporation to make contributions into a retirement plan for the employees. Works very similar to what I mentioned on the 401k front, but it's really in the form of an ESOP and gives the company, again, certain tax benefits to doing that, that you do not necessarily have, in other forms of compensation that's provided to employees.
Well, ESOPs are usually thought of within the context of transitioning ownership in a company. Can you explain the difference between a traditional ESOP and a contributory ESOP?
Yeah, so a very good question, Jerry. And yeah, an example of a traditional ESOP, as most have come to learn and know in the industry space, is, ESOPs can be on any percentage of the company, but in the traditional sense, some pretty big milestones are 30% ESOP, a 51% ESOP, and 100% ESOP. I'll walk through an example that's been very prevalent and common in the industry. You have a company that's a C corp, let's call it a $30 million company. You might have 4 or 5 shareholders, a group of shareholders getting to retirement age, and they might own about 30% of the shares. In that situation, the company would set up an ESOP. The ESOP would, the company would go to a bank, get a loan for $10 million, let's say 30% of the overall value. The company would loan that $10 million to the ESOP, and the ESOP would go ahead and purchase those shares directly from the departing shareholders. Here's where a podcast doesn't do it justice, because it would be nice to have a slide. So if you're out there listening, you can draw some boxes. There is in that situation an internal loan that's created between the company and the ESOP, and those shares are essentially collateralized and then released over a period of time, let's say 10 or 20 years. That would be the traditional ESOP, a leveraged transaction, which is a significant event in any in a company's history. Compare that to a contributory ESOP. What occurs in that situation is the company goes and sets up an ESOP, a plan document, and rather than rather than entering into a transaction, the company simply issues newly issued shares, let's say 3% of qualified payroll, in and deposits those shares into the ESOP. Over a 10-year period, you might get to the same spot where the ESOP would own 3% year one, 6% year two, 9% year three. And over a 10-year period, all of those shares are allocated and you essentially arrive at a similar spot. You just get there a different way.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that that, you know, one of the reasons that companies tend to think about utilizing a contributory ESOP as opposed to a traditional ESOP structure is that in the concept that Joe just described, you are reducing the fiduciary exposure significantly for the trustee who's overseeing the plan, because now the trustee is not necessarily making a decision to purchase stock in the company. They're just accepting a contribution of shares into the plan each year. And so the amount of risk that's associated with that type of a model is substantially less than what it would be under a traditional ESOP construct. Again, of the leverage nature that Joe described.
And beyond that reduced risk, are there other benefits or reasons why owners and sellers would choose to go with a contributory ESOP versus a traditional ESOP?
Yeah. Just say that for some companies, particularly as we sit here today, they're looking for ways to really incentivize, you know, the employees to go above and beyond and really drive, you know, growth in an organization. A contributory ESOP is a way to provide ownership to the employees and start to build that kind of ownership culture without providing direct ownership in the business, right? Which carries its own, you know, sort of complexities that go along with that.
You know, in addition, we have, again, as you compare those two examples, in the contributory ESOP, not that there aren't, but there's a small amount of capital that's invested in the company. But again, it's not a $10 million transaction. It's a small contribution of shares. So it doesn't impact the balance sheet in a way that a traditional leverage transaction would. We've seen it work really well with very long runways, meaning folks that are maybe 50 or in their lower 50s that might have 15 years to retirement. They might say, this is just too early for me to sell. Like the next 10 years are going to be really good and I may not want to exit or liquidate my holdings so soon. In a contributory ESOP model, the percent ownership changes slowly over time. And so you're not timing the market, so to speak, with a particular transaction on a particular date. And it's more of a thought out interval, a process over a 10-year period. And so if you have good years in front of you, or, you know, particularly in the environment that we're in today, if the value is low, I might not want to sell today. But a contributory ESOP would put something in place, communicate to the employees and the company where we're trying to take this entity over time, and provide clarity to all the stakeholders of the firm.
Finally, what are some of the challenges of utilizing an ESOP in this manner?
Yeah, so on the flip side, right? If something is if we're dipping our toe into the water. And we're creating a lot of flexibility for our departing shareholders, you know, it takes some time to create meaningful balances into folks' retirement accounts. So, you know, it's not an overnight success. And, you know, communicating to your employees that they, you know, own the company while, you know, contributing $575 to their retirement account that they're going to have access to in 40 years isn't a bang, you know, out of the gate. So, but that's okay. It takes time, and that's not the intent. It's over the course of a generation, over the course of a decade, you will start to accumulate shares in your account. The value of that will grow. And over time, as you communicate that, it will work. It can work very well, but the small dollar amounts right out of the gate are sometimes, you know, contradictory to, hey, I'm an employee owner. And in addition, you know, there are, as we talked a little bit about the millennial and the generation, is, you know, a lot of folks would rather have a dollar in their pocket today than any dollar in their retirement account. And so just knowing and communicated around that would be important. And there are some, you know, there are some explicit costs of trustees and valuation firms and third party administration that, again, just from a dollars and cents perspective, you'd want to make sure that you are committed to going down this path. That you're committed to going down the path. Otherwise, if you do this for a few years and revert back to something else, it would be some fees spent that could have been gone, that could have gone elsewhere.
Well, great. Well, that's a good and illuminating discussion on contributory ESOPs. I appreciate you guys taking the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us, Jerry. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jerry. Have a good one.